Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at skalarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 41 of Real Talk. This week is the large multifamily conference, NMHC, down in San Diego. So I want to focus today's episode on housing. Look, we traditionally do a lot of apartment transactions here at our firm, buy side, sell side, financing, equity throughout the country. It's obviously been a lot slower, and we are working with a lot of clients, having a lot of discussions, a lot of negotiations with lenders, buying rate caps, extending rate caps, trying to extend maturity dates. Lenders have not been aggressive in pursuing remedies against their borrowers, like we've seen in the office sector. There's just been a lot of conversations and not a lot of action, not a lot of trades. We do have some transactions that we'll be closing here in the next month or two, but it's nothing like what we've seen before. We'll see if this NMHC conference kicks off a lot of activity as we are in 2024. So following with the theme of housing, this week I have Kyle Bach, the CEO of the Annex Group, on the show. And Kyle focuses on affordable housing. And as I've mentioned on prior podcasts, affordable housing is one of the most active, I'll call it sub-asset classes, not just at my firm, but throughout the country. There's an emphasis on building more affordable housing, and a lot of my clients are buying existing affordable housing. A lot of my market rate owner operators are buying existing affordable housing. So Kyle has come onto the show. We recorded it in December. He'll break down the different types of affordable housing programs, how returns are different between affordable and market. And he also talks about student housing and how he has a bit of a counter-cyclical approach compared to most of our other student housing operators. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kyle Bach.
Welcome to another episode of Real Talk. I'm here with my friend Kyle Bach, CEO of the Annex Group. Kyle, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Andrew. Thanks for inviting me to your podcast.
So I think you're the first guest on my show that in the background you have a horseshoe. What's that all about?
So I'm an Indianapolis Colts season ticket holder.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's tough. Trust me.
No, you're having a good year, Gardner Minshew. He's holding his own.
He's holding it together. It's just, you know, I'm used to much better football. And so it's, I mean, they're a win's a win, as they say, correct. But it's been tough to watch this year.
So if you're used to much better football, you're talking about the Peyton Manning years of like 10, 12 years ago.
Peyton Manning and then followed up by Andrew Luck. I mean, how fortunate can one city be with two, you know, Hall of Fame quarterbacks? So now we've just been kicking it around. I suppose we could be the Bears, right? And have gone through like 25 QBs over the past three decades.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, we could talk about NFL for 30 minutes. And maybe that's why I had you on the show, just to talk about football. But on a serious note, we've known each other for a year or two, and I want to hear all about, you know, the Annex Group and sort of as a precursor. The reason why I was most interested in having you on wasn't just because of your dancing abilities that I've seen at NMHC in Vegas. And I don't know what you're going to do this year now that NMHC is back in San Diego. So we'll have to find a club. But you guys do a lot of affordable housing. And although this year the market has been sluggish and the number of transactions that we've been working on has been a lot lower compared to 2021 and 22, the one asset class or sub-asset class where it's just been ripping and we've been doing more and more transactions in this one sub-asset class is affordable. And so I know that's what you guys do. But first, before we get into the nuts and bolts of affordable housing, talk about the Annex Group and what you guys do.
Sure. So we're based here in Indianapolis. We have a Chicagoland and a Denver office. We're exclusively focused on multifamily investments. We do, like you alluded to, affordable housing. We have a sizable student housing portfolio and then some conventional housing. Full service. So we're the developer GC, owner and operator. Got about an asset valuation of about $1.5 billion, and we're currently in 17 states.
Got it. Okay. So, and then what's, I guess, informing the Annex Group, being in predominantly along with student housing in affordable, you know, what is your guys' sort of mission and purpose?
Sure. So our blanket mission statement is to make a positive impact to the people who live, work, and are involved in our communities. And it really stems from my personal experience at Indiana University and being a young, vulnerable man at, you know, 17, 18 year old and getting involved into a housing community that really propelled me to where I am today. And so, you know, we pay special attention to building buildings. And of course, those have to be profitable. But at the end of the day, it's about the impact and difference that we make into our residents. So we oftentimes, as an operator, think that turnover is a good thing. You know, you see most operators want to keep their turnover line item on their OPEX to a minimal level. For us, we believe that to be the most effective use of our time is to make sure that we're, if we, for example, if we have an affordable resident who ultimately wants to own a home, it's our responsibility to help get there.
Yeah, no, that's great. Very, you know, impactful being in the business of providing housing. We lose sight of, it's not just, dollars and cents, but it's where people live. And that's why there's a lot of, you know, special interest groups, a lot of focus on the multifamily, apartment business as a whole, and especially affordable housing, which is front and center in almost every state, every municipality. And so, you know, what I'd love to do in our discussion here is to talk about what does it mean when people say affordable housing, because there's all different types of affordable housing. There's different government programs. So can you give us a primer, and then we'll probably go into certain paths of each one of affordable housing in general?
Sure. So I think the most prominent financing vehicle in the affordable housing space is the low-income housing tax credit, right? And so I know, Andrew, your company does a lot of representation of developers and lenders and syndicators and such. And so really there are two different programs within the LIHTC program. There's a 9% and a 4%. The 9% program is extremely competitive. And the 4% program about three or four years ago wasn't nearly as competitive as it is today. But the federal government came in during some of the COVID relief and decided to lock the 4% rate, which they did for the 9% program about a decade ago. And so it really had an influx of interest into the 4% program. Again, most states being non-competitive.
Okay, let's even take a step further back. When you say 9% and 4%, for my audience who may not have even dealt with affordable housing, what are you even talking about?
Sure. So it's a whole different category pro forma, right? But effectively what that means is the 9% program, you are selling your tax credits that developer receives for equity into the project. And the tax credit investor is then paying a certain percentage for that dollar of benefit to their ordinary income. So depending on location, there could be Community Reinvestment Act needs, a variety of different scenarios on what an equity investor or a syndicator is going to pay for that credit. But for easy math, let's say you have a $10 million total project, which of course doesn't exist today, but you're in a 9% program, you're almost eligible to get 90% of the equity needed for that project via the sale of those tax credits. And then the same would be true then for 4%, so just less than half the value of equity into that particular transaction.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And so when you enter into these programs that provide equity towards these deals, how long do you have to keep the building or the property affordable And I guess the second part of that question is, what does affordable mean in terms of who your tenant base needs to be?
Sure. So I will start with the second question first, because by and large, it really is 60% of the area median income, right? And of course, the area median incomes vary from county to county throughout the United States. But by and large, it's at or below 60% of the area median income. And as far as affordability is concerned, this is a federally governed program that although administered by each state. And typically each state has it's called a qualified allocation plan or a QAP that highlights the rules and regulations for that particular state. And so it's a minimum to maintain that building for 15 years of affordability, but you're really seeing a lot of state agencies mandate it for 30 years and beyond.
Mm-hmm. And when you are buying a site, or I guess let me take a step back, what percentage of your deals are ground up development versus buying existing affordable housing deals?
Good question. So today it's 100% new construction. I will tell you though, we have just launched an acquisitions division, and we believe we enter in that for a variety of reasons. We see a lot of, like you, a lot of loan maturities coming along, a lot of state agencies really pushing towards acquisition renovation of existing affordable units. You typically get less credits, and states are limited in the amount of credits they can allocate on an annual basis. So a lot of states you'll see give priority for ACT rehab projects. We've traditionally taken the stance of new construction because, again, we are our general contractor and everything that we've built to date has been new construction. And so we like controlling the construction, the design, and what we're building as opposed to taking someone else. But we are interested in the acquisition and see an opportunity, certainly in 24 and beyond, for that strategy.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's walk us through, to the extent you're able to share, the capital stack of a typical deal. We'll start with a development deal. So your typical deal, I don't know, how many units are you building on a typical transaction?
Well, what I'll do, actually, we just closed a deal today. So okay. It's in downtown Des Moines, Iowa.
Congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. So locked in at a 620 rate, right? Not bad, right? So we were at 611 last week and locked it in today at 620. But
and this is a construction financing?
It is. It's a construction loan. Yeah. Okay. And so that particular deal is about 254 units.
Mm-hmm.
And it's roughly a $70 million project.
Okay.
And so roughly of the $70 million, about half of that is debt, right? Is construction to perm debt. And then we've got about 28%, 29% of the stack via the tax credit equity. And then a lot of these transactions, Andrew, particularly in the 4% deals, have a variety of different soft funds. And so in this particular transaction, we have a tax increment financing to the tune of about $8 million into the total project. The city has some trust fund dollars. The city has some ARPA fund dollars, and then a handful of perhaps like fee waivers or other types of grants. And so I think when we closed this deal, we had 12 different sources into the project.
Wow. And then what about private capital that's not tax credit or the LIHTC equity?
Very limited private capital. I think what we would see is we would put in as the developer a GP note, as opposed to us raising or syndicating any of that capital if necessary. We don't like to do that for obvious reasons, but if we have to get the deal across the finish line, we'll certainly consider it. But 100% of this particular transaction was financed through soft funds, permanent debt, and tax credit equity.
And how, once you build and take it to stabilization, what's your business plan of how long you will own and operate?
So our business plan today within our tax credit portfolio is to hold for perpetuity. I mean, we want to get to 25,000 doors throughout the United States. And you asked a question. So the Des Moines deal, like I said, was 254 units. But on average, our 4% deals are roughly 200 units. Handful at 180, handful at 240, you know, so 2 to 220 units is really our sweet spot for development. Mm-hmm. And we're looking to close anywhere from 8 to 10 deals a year.
And if you were, well, do you build any market rate?
So we just opened up one in Bozeman, Montana. We actually originally slated that for purpose-built student housing for Montana State University. But we saw what was going on in the market even prior to COVID. And so we got pretty fortunate there because a lot of folks from your neck of the woods moved over to Bozeman.
Yep.
And so we saw a fairly nice premium on our rental rates. And then we've got a transaction in Raleigh, North Carolina that actually was slated as a 4% tax credit deal. And we got credits from the state housing agency, but that's when costs. So on the flip side for that, that's when costs went up 40%. And so the economics on an affordable deal did not work on that deal in Raleigh. And so we pivoted to make that a conventional market rate deal.
Yeah. So, cause what I was going to ask you is, how do you compare the returns to the Annex Group in building affordable versus building market rate? Or is it just apples and oranges? It's hard to compare.
It is hard to compare, but I will tell you in the three different investment vehicles that we have, you know, the tax credit business is long-term hold, heavy fee business. So developer fee, GC fee, we're the manager, asset manager fees, and they cash flow pretty well. And so the LP is a little bit different in that scenario where the LPs take advantage of the tax credits against their ordinary income. So that's the tax credit bucket is the long-term hold, a lot of ordinary income, good cash flow on the back end. And then our conventional is really a merchant build scenario. So we'll, you know, stabilize and sell. And then our student portfolio is in between. So we'll look to have like a 5 to 7 year hold within our student platform, take a lot of the depreciation from that. A lot of the LP capital in that scenario is more patient than our conventional capital. And we'll be the, you know, the GP in those two arenas as well.
Mm-hmm. So going back to that Des Moines, Iowa deal. So once you're stabilized, your loan automatically converts to a permanent loan?
That's correct.
And how much term do you have?
That deal was 45 years.
Wow. Okay. So yeah. That's obviously not typical for a market rate deal. And so do you think you will just live with that? I know you want to own this in perpetuity. Are you going to refinance based on where rates are when you're done with construction? Or is the idea that this is it, this is your financing and you'll live with it for the duration of the term?
Yeah, we could lock in, and this one's on a swap, right? And so a little different scenario in here, but yeah, we have our perm rate locked if we want it. We could look to refinance, but we rarely do that in the affordable world, but could if necessary.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I'm representing market rate buyers, not necessarily developers, but market rate buyers, class B buyers of multifamily, they're very geographically, what's important is the location, right? Jobs, demographics, the political climate, etc. And as you can imagine, over the last several years, even though I'm in Los Angeles and most of my clients are based in Los Angeles, we're doing deals throughout the country, a lot in the Sun Belt, Texas, Florida, Nashville, Carolinas. And then I pivot because a lot of my affordable, my clients who buy existing affordable, we're transacting in markets that I've never transacted before. These small towns in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Ohio that my market rate buyers would never go into. Mm-hmm. So is it that for affordable deals, it's really less about the geography and just more about the asset because they know that asset's going to be 99% occupied regardless?
Yeah, that's, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, right? The demand for affordable housing is stronger than it's ever been. And for the foreseeable future, it's not going to change, right? And so, you know, the occupancy risk is minimal, right? And we find that in the same thing. I mean, you know, Des Moines is a mid-market, but we've made a living. We do a lot in Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, the Midwest, and then we're out west in Oregon and Washington. Of course, we'd love some operational synergies, right, to continue to build or buy in markets that we're already in. But I would venture to guess if you were to ask your clients why they're buying in middle of Pennsylvania is because they know that that project's going to be full forever.
Mm-hmm. And then it's just a cash on cash play.
Correct.
Yeah. How have cap rates, I know you're more of a developer, but how have cap rates evolved over the last 12 months in affordable compared to market rate?
Not impacted nearly as much as you would find on market rate, mm-hmm. right? But clearly, you know, some of our market rate transactions has been a real big challenge. It's like, okay, how are we going to size this deal up today? What's our cap rate sensitivity on an exit? But thankfully for the affordable world, we're not nearly as cap rate sensitive as the market rate world.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about your other sub asset class, student housing, mm-hmm. and how many transactions of student housing? Well, let me take even a step back. Are you developing student housing or are you buying existing?
Developing. Yeah. We're a much better developer than we are an acquirer, okay. at least at this point today. But what I see in trending here, and it's been in play for, I guess, the past decade, but more prominently today, is universities, community colleges really going through a P3 type scenario. I mean, I see one in Orange County or California at least once a week of a large institution trying to partner with somebody like ourselves to perhaps get an off balance sheet type scenario. And so we were just awarded almost a 600 bed project at University of Memphis. We have an operating asset there, so we're familiar with the market. But that was a P3 scenario in which we partnered with the university.
And when you say P3, you want to explain what?
Yeah, public. It means public private partnership, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that particular scenario, the university, it will be working in tandem with a not-for-profit organization that would yield a 100% tax exempt bond scenario. The university gets really the long-term ownership. We're just really mostly the fee developer, contractor, and manager in that scenario. And so we see a lot of those transactions coming down the pike, and we're a finalist for another institution actually here in the state of Indiana, and looking to submit a couple of more of those opportunities because I see that trend continuing to grow. The other trend that I see is when you talk the non-Power 5 schools, so, you know, here in Indiana, let's say it's Indiana State University, they've seen a fairly sizable enrollment drop. And working in tandem with the university to perhaps decommission some of their beds for better use on campus, so that they're providing a really good housing solution for their students, unfortunately, just may not be what they've already built.
Yeah. And so is there a, because I have clients who focus on those Power 5 schools. So is yours more of a counter to that thesis of going to schools that these larger institutional student housing owner operators are just not focusing on?
Yeah, that's correct. And a lot of my peers in that space may have some issues with our thesis from exitability, LP availability, all of those things. But really our thesis has always been in that strategy is just because somebody can't get into or afford a Power 5 institution doesn't mean they can't have the same experience, right? And so, yeah, we go in with kind of lower return expectations than the Power 5 schools would, but we know that going in and have been effective in doing so.
Yeah. How does the return on cost compare building student housing versus building affordable?
So again, affordable, different financing metrics, but what I will tell you from our conventional to student, we're probably 100 bips difference to the student. And that has been a safe metric for us over the course of doing so.
Yeah. So let's talk about just construction in general. How, how have construction costs fared recently in the last, you know, well, I guess let's talk about, you know, the deal you're closing, you just closed today. How are you performing your construction costs compared to a deal that you signed up, I don't know, 6 to 12 months ago?
Yeah, so we have a complete pre-construction division that works in tandem with our contractor in addition to the design team. So we've got our hands really on the numbers from day one. But I will tell you, for the first time in probably 18 months, the subcontract agreements we are signing are below budget. We probably saved 6%, but on a, you know, $50 million construction contract, that's a sizable number. We just got bids back for our Raleigh project that I had mentioned coming in under budget. So again, I haven't said it for the past 2 years, but I've said it now on two projects that are real for us.
Yeah. And then on this, going back to the student housing product, are you, how are you capitalizing those deals?
Yeah, that's typically just a conventional deal. I mean, we'll get 60 to 65% debt. This is a debt and equity transaction, right? So not the tax exempt bond structure I mentioned previously, but on a traditional debt and equity, it's 60 to 65% leverage. We're typically partnering with one, two, or three of our lending relationships that we've been working with for, you know, decade and a half or so. We haven't really chased any new lending relationships, thankfully, which my peers have, you know, been a challenge. And then we're, you know, looking at our traditional LP partners, high net worth individuals, family offices. We've worked with a couple of institutional guys. And then, you know, we're putting in our portion 10 to 20% of the GP typically on those.
And so your capital partnerships, whether it's on the lending side or the equity side for your conventional deals, how have they responded to your deal activity? Same interest, less interest, more interest this past year?
Our lenders are still interested. The LP has pulled back substantially.
Yeah.
And in fact, in full candor, I think to capitalize our Raleigh deal, we may go the pref equity route, which, you know, I don't want to do. But in today's market, it may be the only thing available for us. And we're just being ultra conservative on our assumptions. But I'm sure you've done those deals in the past. I mean, it's a bit more risk involved from the operator or the sponsor standpoint.
Yeah, look, it's almost every deal that I'm doing now has a component of preferred equity, whether it's a ground up development deal, a recap deal, buying an existing deal. Look, senior debt is the leverage is lower. The common equity is harder to come by. And there's a gap. And so there's also a reason why we're representing a lot of preferred equity providers. So we see it both as a borrower and as a capital provider. And it's a needed source in order to make a deal work. And I think it's going to be a required part of the capital stack for the foreseeable future. I know the 10-year has come down some from 5 to now as we're recording, you know, in the 4.2 range, 4.25 range, but still we're a ways to go before where we were. Not saying that we need to go back to 0% interest rates, but a healthy rate where there's a healthy amount of transactional volume.
I would agree.
Yeah. So going forward, as you're, you know, we're at the end of the year, you know, going into 2024, what is Annex Group's business plan?
So, you know, these, as you know, in development, you know, again, all we do is development. Those things take 24 to 36 months. So fortunately for us, we've got our pipeline pretty much baked for 2024. We should close 8 new construction tax credit deals and 2 new construction student housing deals. We may get 1 or 2 additional ones to fall within 2024. We have budgeted substantially less in our closings and completions, but feel that you know, we can get in the ground on about 2,500 plus units in 2024.
Have you seen any distressed opportunities where you can come in and buy a project that's, you know, half complete, or maybe it's complete, but you need to lease it up, or any aspect within distress?
I will tell you again, for our interest in distress, what I have seen is a lot of developers who are pregnant in transactions. You know, maybe they own the real estate, you know, they're seven figures deep in design and just can't get it financed, right? And so we have stepped in a couple of those where we can introduce our affordable financing vehicle and ultimately be able to recoup the developer at least their cost or their basis to date to be able to use our financing execution. A couple of which have asked to partner with us, which we will also consider as long as we're in control. So I've seen a lot of those, Andrew. As far as, you know, stabilization or under construction, I've heard of them, but that's just not our expertise or our execution.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess in our remaining moments here, since affordable has become very popular and just necessary as a country to make sure we are able to deliver an affordable housing product to as many people, you know, is there, I mean, you talk about the relationships and the 12 different sources of capital for your Des Moines, Iowa deal. I mean, just talk about how long it takes or has taken the Annex Group to develop these types of relationships. So if somebody is looking to get into the affordable housing industry and they haven't previously, you can't just wake up one day and say, I want to be an affordable housing developer based on how many different constituencies you're working with. So can you give us a sense of how long it takes and what advice you would give someone that wants to get into the affordable housing industry?
Sure. So it does take a lot of time, a lot of patience, and a lot of capital. I will tell you a bit of piece of advice that I've given peers and in my internal team is that the one constant that I can tell you over doing this over two decades is if the city or the municipality wants you there, they will help you get there, right? For a first-time developer looking to jump into space, you know, I would highly encourage you to partner with somebody who has experience. And quite often it's a requirement for each state that you partner with somebody who has had experience in that particular state. It is a lot of time spent with the state housing agency who ultimately allocates the funds. And so it's important to be friendly and engaging with the state agency to the extent that you can. I mean, they're truly your partners in this. I will tell you some states are a lot better than others in their ability to work with and work with developers as partners. But we also know that now. And so we know certain states, and I won't tell you those on this podcast, just in case somebody's listening from that state. But there are several that we just won't go into because they're either too difficult to work with just have no interest in doing ultimately what they're supposed to be doing and providing affordable housing for that state.
Well, I mean, look, the state that I'm in California, and even, you know, in the Southern California municipalities, the city of LA and Karen Bass, who's our mayor, who's been preaching affordable housing. Look, everyone preaches affordable housing, but the problem is it's not easy to build, especially in infill areas like in Los Angeles. And, you know, there are NIMBYs who don't want it in their backyard, and other environmental groups who are concerned about development and other aspects that just make development challenging. And very few people have the stomach to go through a multi-year entitlement process. It just drains the returns and doesn't make it profitable.
Sure.
So it's obviously something as a country, as a society, we need to fix. And I applaud you guys at the Annex Group of trying to make a dent in the lack of affordable housing, but we need everybody to cooperate in getting this done and solving this issue.
Yes, sir. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, look, Kyle, I appreciate you coming on. I wanted to give my audience a sense of the affordable housing product type. And I know you're one of the leaders, not just in your region in Indiana, but throughout the country. And so hopefully our listeners, you know, were able to learn about this aspect of real estate. And I just thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the invite. I look forward to seeing you at the next YPO or NMHC event. Absolutely. And if we want to go take swings at a ballpark again, I would certainly accept an invitation to do so.
That's right, Kyle. That was a proud moment of mine since I couldn't hit a home run while I was in college. I had to hit one from like 180 feet away, standing on second base at Petco Park with you.
Yeah, and I was honestly embarrassed that I didn't get one over. So I applaud you.
Next time.
All right,
well, look forward to seeing you. Happy holidays, and thanks for coming on.
All right, see you, brother.
All right, Kyle. Take care. Bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.